This show is furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervie. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. And now, here's your host, Alan Gervie.
Good evening, Los Angeles, and everyone listening all over the world on KABC.com. I am Alan Gervie, the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn, and today I am here to be the managing partner of your life, and I'm here with Lauren Savon. I just lied because I'm not here with Lauren Savon. She is somewhere else. Lauren, where are you?
Well, I'm here. I don't know where
you're here, so yeah. Where am I?
That's a good question. I'm in the studio.
No one knows where I am.
You are in an undisclosed location.
Undisclosed location. I am not in Los Angeles. It's a mystery, but I think it's exciting that it's a mystery.
And, I love a mystery.
You do love a mystery, and I'm unable to be in Los Angeles, especially tonight. I guess there's a baseball game going on now.
There sure is.
And most people who are listening to the show don't care, because if they cared, they'd be watching the game or at least listening to the game if they're in their cars.
Fair point.
What about you? Are you watching the game?
I mean, as you know, there are TVs in this studio.
I do know that.
So it's possible to walk and chew gum while hosting this show, if you will.
Yes. And many a time I have watched TV during the show, paid very little attention to what was going on air because it was more interesting watching the television.
Yeah.
I hate to admit that, but it's true.
Hey, listen, it happens, right? It's too much. We're overstimulated in here. Too much going on.
Now, Lauren, you've done so much media, way more than me. Do you sometimes find yourself being distracted by other things when you're on the air?
Yeah, all the time, of course.
Really? What are you distracted by?
Oh, just, you know, any and all matter.
any and all matter?
Yeah, like if you're reading a news story and then your mind just goes off to like, did I turn my curling iron off? And then that distracts you and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I always think about that.
Sometimes you always think about whether or not you turned off your curling iron?
Yeah, I just can't remember. It really bothers me, and you know, it always reminds me. And I think I've said this like 100 times. One of my favorite movies, My Dinner with Andre, and you know, I saw Wallace Shawn is on another show tonight. I happened to be getting distracted, and I saw, but you know, when he's in that on that show, and you know, hey. They're talking about the meaning of life and all this stuff, and all he's thinking about, did I feed my cat tonight?
Yes, exactly.
So that's sometimes how things go rather than getting into the depths of life. But I have to admit, I'm watching the Dodger game. So wherever I am in my mystery location, I certainly can watch the Dodger game. And I'm watching, it's funny because I was watching Max Fried. They just took him out of the game pitching for the Braves. Atlanta is an important place for one of our guests today, because that's his home base. But watching Max Fried when he was a kid, I wasn't a kid. I watched him over in Encino Little League. He was pitching and playing in Encino Little League, and one of my friend's kids played. Jason Garfinkel played with him, and then they played together at Harvard Westlake. So. It's a long history for Alan Gervie watching Max Fried, so I'm kind of torn whether to hope for the Dodgers or Max Fried and the Braves.
Right, I can see.
What do you think?
Long history. What do I think? Who do I think you should root for?
Yeah,
The Dodgers, obviously.
Okay. Well, Max Fried's out of the game. Dodgers are winning.
Well, that's even
more. If you're listening to this on the podcast, who cares? Because it's like weeks or months later, and we all know what happened. After this, but right now we don't.
Right, correct. But you know, we have a lot to focus on today. So much information.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I thought you were leading into our guests.
I am. I mentioned Atlanta. But you know, I have to say that this is a first for Gervie's Law. It is really a first because we have never had a brother sister tandem on the show. Who were over 8 years old. We have had brother sisters on the show many times, but they've all been under 8 years old. So this is really quite a deal for us, for Gervie's Law. Do you know who the brother sister duo has been? That's
I do.
Under
it's
eight?
The Bremer siblings.
Under eight? No, they are.
Oh, I don't know who the under eight crowd is. No.
Yeah, the under eight crowd. That would be Hudson Gervie and Harper Gervie.
That was my first guess. Yes.
Yeah, that would be the only under eight brother sister tandem. But today we really have a really interesting show. I mean, it's always nice to have Ann Bremner on the show. She's been on the show so many times, and she's in our top 40 guests. So for those of you who have not seen our top 40 for the last 9 years, go to our website at gervieslaw.com, and you will see Ann Bremner right up there in the 20s. So it's exciting to have her, as most people know, well-known Seattle attorney, frequent legal analyst. She's just been about on every show you can think of.
Yeah.
She's a former prosecutor. She's covered Scott Peterson trial, Michael Jackson, Casey Anthony. Been involved significantly with the Mary Kay Letourneau cases, and also, of course, Amanda Knox, who we're going to talk about today. So, should we welcome Ann now and then talk about her brother? Because I really didn't realize that Ann has such an accomplished brother. I mean, this brother and sister team, they've taken over the world. Ann, are you there?
I'm here.
I had you stunned. You were frozen in time.
Yeah. Well, it's such a pleasure to be on with you, and I'd love to talk about my little brother. He's amazing.
Your parents must be proud. Too well accomplished.
Very.
Yeah.
So tell us, Ann, why don't you, because I have an introduction for Doug, but, it's your little brother. He is such an accomplished, and you know what I love about him? I've been reading a lot of his writing, his blogs and everything. He tells it like it is. This is no sugarcoating. This is no academic, even though he is an academic and a scholar, but man, can the guy write. Tell us about him.
Exactly. You know, Doug is majored in English at the University of Puget Sound, and then went on to medical school at Duke, and then taught at Yale, and now teaches at Emory. And
Emory.
He's got a PhD in nuclear medicine. He's a psychiatrist, and he did groundbreaking research in PTSD. Basically, he was the one that discovered that experience can change your brain. It can actually cause brain damage. I mean, he did the studies. He thought about it. And prove that that was the case. And so he's amazing. He's written a lot of books. He's a very good writer, and he does tell it like it is. He's got a book called Before You Take That Pill about the pharmaceutical industry. But he's also written books like You Just Can't Snap Out of It, you know, helping people with getting through trauma, you know, and how to get to the other side. He's also written very technical books about the brain. And he is a brain. And when I went to write this book that we're going to talk about, I enlisted Doug because he's the best writer that I know. And he's brilliant and he's funny. He's also got a connection to Italy, which is part of the Amanda Knox case. He worked on the Amanda Knox case tirelessly. His wife is Sicilian, and his kids, of course, are Italian. So Doug speaks Italian, can read Italian, and became very interested in the injustice of the Amanda Knox case, you know, back when she was being prosecuted. So he's really amazing, and I love him. Of course, he's my brother. But he and I have had a lot of fun putting this together, and he's just an amazing talent. And
how convenient that you have
things about him.
Yeah, you have someone like that in your gene pool.
I know. And my parents are very proud, And Doug's very humble. You know, he sounds
humble because he's sitting, taking a back seat right now. What an amazing introduction, better than any introduction that I could ever do. Doug, wow, this is something. Have you ever been introduced like that? Something that, you know, you want to savor and maybe play for your kids.
No, that's about the best introduction I've ever had. Thanks for having me on, Nellan. I appreciate it.
It's great to have you. You know, we've had Ann on so many times, and we just love her. She's so insightful with her legal commentary. What is really interesting is how insightful you also are, even in the legal arena, with a background in medicine and psychiatry and research. But we're going to talk about this book after the break. I was so impressed with how you were able to kind of jump in your own style and really add something to the book that, you know, it's not that Anne was deficient in it, but to get another Bremner in there that's really putting something important on paper. How did you approach that?
Well, this has really been a great opportunity for me. You know, when I was a kid, I always thought I wanted to be a writer, and then they told me I should go to medical school because you couldn't make any money being a writer. But there's a lot of great stories. And so one of the things that I put into the book was, one of the chapters is about the opening statement. So it says, you know, this chapter starts out saying the most important thing of a law case is the opening statement. And then it says, let me say that again. The most important thing about a case is the opening statement. And then the chapter ends with, it's all about being a great storyteller. So that's sort of the way I see the law. And I tell people I've spent as much time in courts as many lawyers have, because I've been an expert witness for pharmaceutical safety cases and for PTSD cases. And then, you know, some other things that I can't go into. But anyway, so I've been a lot in the courtroom, and there was, and I used to write on the Huffington Post, and I would write about my experiences as an expert witness. And one of the blog posts I wrote was called Deposition X. It was because I've been deposed so many times in this one case, I lost track. And I was afraid I'd get up to the 13th deposition. But this book has been great because, for one thing, Ann and I have a shared childhood history. So a lot of the stuff I could just sort of write because I knew what the stories were. And then I got really involved in the Amanda Knox case because of my connection with Italy. And then some of the other cases I sort of followed, and I'd gone on Nancy Grace for the Top Mom case and Anthony case.
Doug, don't forget with your connection with Anne as well. You got involved with Amanda Knox with Anne as well, and that's what we're going to talk about after the break. The book is called Amanda Knox and Justice in the Age of Judgment. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC. Yeah, we're back, and we're talking to Anne Bremner, Seattle attorney, Doug Bremner, her brother, Atlanta psychiatrist, researcher, blogger, writer. The book is called Amanda Knox and Justice in the Age of Judgment. Basically, parenthetically, it's Amanda Knox's Attorney Tells All and What It Means for Justice Today. And, you know, you do such a great job. And I know the book isn't out yet. You're going to have to talk about the release, and we've seen an advanced copy. So just an amazing, amazing job both of you did. It's such an easy read. So I think people are really going to enjoy it. But tell us the genesis of it. You like to talk about in the book how you got involved in the Amanda Knox case, which is a fascinating story. Tell us the genesis of the book.
Well, it basically came out of the fact that she was wrongfully convicted, and how her case really arose in a time when social media was exploding, the internet was exploding, you know, things had really changed. It was an international murder case. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, we were really well equipped to deal with that. And so it was basically people made up their minds about her immediately. She was doing cartwheels at the police station. They said she was shopping for lingerie. She was kissing her boyfriend. You know, that's what the Italians said the probable cause was, to arrest her for murder. And she was just vilified in the international press, especially in Italy and in the UK. And it never changed. And that's the whole idea of like an opening statement. There's research, although it's not, you know, solidified, that 80% of jurors make up their minds in opening statements, and they never change. They filter all the evidence through what they first heard. So that got me interested in exploring this, you know, in this age of, you know, internet media and judgment that happens immediately. And we kind of end the book with the Stillwater movie, which Amanda talked about in the Atlantic.
She's been pretty vocal about it.
She's like, this is not my story. That the only voice that wasn't heard in this case was mine. That's what she said. And that movie, of course, said she was guilty and was based on her story. So we're exploring those kinds of things that we see in social media, in the media, and how it, you know, basically intersects with our justice system.
Lauren?
Oh, I'm sorry, Alan. I just didn't know you were waiting for me to ask a question. Yeah, this case was fascinating. I remember being, you know, kind of glued to it. And as you point out in the book, you know, there was just so many titillating facets of it that's the news that traveled so fast and internationally, you know, that it was the, you know, sex games and it was an international murder. And it was these young, beautiful kids. And I don't know how, as a lawyer, that you can combat that when those types of, you know, facts get leaked out, or maybe it wasn't even facts, and, you know, information gets leaked out. And also, you know, the fact that the Italian legal system seems so different from ours.
It is. And what we tasked ourselves with was basically trying to turn around a supertanker of false and salacious information, which means you just got to keep getting the evidence and the truth out there. We released the crime scene videos to NBC, and it kind of was a shout, you know, heard around the world, mm-hmm. which basically, I mean, they were, you know, erasing, you know, bloody footprints, handprints. They were, it looked like a video from something that someone shot, you know, in grade school. I mean, it was unbelievable that this was the Amanda Knox crime scene. And I only bring that up because at the very end, when she was finally exonerated, we had said in the beginning that the evidence was compromised, contaminated, and inadmissible. There was a knife and a bra clasp. And at the end of the day, the independent experts in Italy that were appointed said the same thing. Mm. And she was exonerated. There was no other evidence, no fibers, no fingerprints, no nothing. And so that's all they had, but they didn't have anything.
Hmm. Yeah.
How then can they get away with it? I mean, I understand social media and Mignini, the prosecutor, you know, okay. presented a crappy case. How does this happen?
Well, it really was like Duke LaCrosse. We called it Duke LaCrosse Italian style. Remember Mike Nifong, who wrongfully prosecuted those boys? And he was actually convicted, disbarred, and he went to jail. Mignini, the prosecutor in this case, was accused of abuse of office during Amanda's case. And convicted. And he was really the reason, I mean, we can talk about the Italian system, but the real reason that she was wrongfully prosecuted was one person, and that was Mignini. And he, you know, he believed in satanic cults, you know, he called her the she-devil. I mean, the kinds of things that you've never seen in the United States,
right?
You know, from a prosecutor. And so how did this happen? And that's exactly how it happened. But also, she was portrayed as a sex fiend that led a ritualistic slaying. And what was lost in the media was that there was someone named Rudy Gadet who committed the murder, and he was convicted of the murder. And, you know, his evidence, DNA was there. He had confessed on Skype. He had fled the jurisdiction. And this was the guy. But people will always say, well, then who did it? Mm-hmm. And I would say it was Rudy Gadet, and he was convicted. But that's been lost in the media.
No one knows that name. Yeah. Even now.
Right.
You know, you have a connection to Italy. Did you find, and you were following the case closely, as you've said, did you find that there was a different perception in Italy versus other places in the world? Or is that just the justice system that Italians have grown to understand from previous cases?
Well, I mean, this is really interesting for me, of course, because, you know, my wife's family is there, and you know, we even bought a place in Italy now. So, and as I was writing the book, you know, sort of the first go around when you're writing on blogs and whatnot, it became sort of an Italy versus England and the UK. And I actually got sort of attacked by people on Twitter from the UK, and then eventually got banned on Twitter, probably because of that connection. So it became a America versus everyone else kind of thing. So when we went to write the book, I kind of tried to get into a little bit more detail, and I tried to learn about the Italian legal system and was able to correct some of the misperceptions, I think, that have been in the media about the Italian system, you know, because my wife's cousin is a lawyer and his wife is a lawyer, and they helped me with some of that. And it's a completely different system, as you know. I mean, it's civil versus common law, and, you know, their laws are basically, they don't go on precedent. There's a descendant of Napoleonic law. But the other thing I tried to do is I wrote a couple of new chapters. And so the book is actually expanded beyond Amadinox. So the current title is Justice and Age of Judgment, from Amadinox to Brett Kavanaugh and Me Too. And so we have a new chapter on the West Memphis Three, where there's a similar thing of a prosecutor run amok, where they had the same idea about the satanic cult, and they did the same thing of leaking to the press and prejudicing the jury, and it turned out to be a complete pack of lies. Mm. We also have a chapter on the Duke lacrosse case. We kind of expanded that because that was another example of a prosecutor run off the rails.
How does this figure into the Me Too movement?
Well, the Me Too movement was that was sort of the idea was that we shouldn't let the social. So one of the themes, the main theme of the book is that how social media can influence court, mm-hmm. high profile court cases. So we talked about Michael Jackson. You have a chapter about O.J. Simpson. And so with the Me Too, it was sort of like the rush to accuse before, you know, we've really heard all the evidence. So that's sort of the idea of that. A lot of that was what Anne had written. It was sort of, you know, believe women. But when you really dissect that down and say, well, what does that really mean, believe women? Does that mean you believe them all the time? Because we know that, you know, there are women who make false accusations, mm-hmm. just like there are men that make false accusations. So that was sort of it's a delicate balancing act. You know, we talked a little bit about Harvey Weinstein, but then we kind of took it out because it didn't really gel with the,
right.
you know, with the theme.
Well, what's interesting, and I'm glad, Doug, that you clarified the title, because I understand it's a work in progress, and it makes a lot of sense, because when you look at the different chapters, there's so many other situations and people involved in the book, and so you get a whole gamut of different issues, but some of them go back. You know, you talk about O.J., Francis Farmer, Betty Broderick, you've got all of these references, Mary Kay Letourneau, but a lot of these instances were before the whole social media explosion and, of course, the Me Too movement. So how do you reconcile the older cases with what's going on now and in the last several years, where social media has really become a prevalent part in public opinion?
Well, Francis Farmer was sort of, you know, killed by the press. It was just, it wasn't as fast, you know. So they wrote bad articles about her. I went and looked them up on, you know, newspapers.com, where they, you know, said she was insane and that she, you know, needed correction or whatever. And that they quoted her in a way that made her look, you know, very bad. But now we still have the press and the social media affects things. But, you know, it's sort of like an accelerant. And, you know, we say that the Maddox case was kind of the precursor of the 2020 election, because you had the same sort of divided camps, and you had a lot of people doing their own research and getting stuff on the internet that turned out not to be true. And there's a lot of bloggers writing about things. And, you know, there's even some evidence that there's some sort of Putin, you know, promoters that were using this as a way to drive a wedge between the America and Europe, you know, so. There's a lot of parallels there, but I think that, you know, we're just sort of speeding up now with social media. And Amadinox was really the first case where we saw that to this degree.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I think when you say it's speeding up, that makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I know we're talking about the book, and it's a fascinating story still to this day, but I also wanted to ask Doug, about his take on vaccines, as I've read a couple of different articles that you've contributed to. I don't know if we have enough time to get into that, or if we should hold it to the
vaccines. That's just a real small topic. You know, it's only about 10 seconds, so I'm being sarcastic. we will address that in the next segment, because it's a great question. We only have about 30 or 40 seconds, so I want to ask Anne, tell us where you are in the book and when you're looking to have it released, because I know it's a work in progress.
Well, we're doing an advanced copy course, which you have, and we're hoping to publish by the end of the year, first of next year, to make sure that we really have it polished and relevant. You know, right now, true crime is huge. And I don't know what's because of the pandemic and people are watching Netflix and, you know, watching true crime stories or whatever. There's one that's part of the aspect of the case. But the intersection of true crime media and justice, I think, is something we want to really explore in a way that's meaningful to our readers.
And there's also some personal anecdotes, which I think we can talk about it in a few minutes.
You bet.
We have to take a break. But it's fascinating to get into the Bremner household and, you know, and how you, these brains, both of you, developed and your mindset. And we'll hear about that after the break. You're listening to Curry's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC. Yeah, we are back. I'm Alan Gervey. I'm here with Lauren Savant. Well, not here. She's in L.A. I'm at a mystery location, not in L.A. And we are speaking, I don't know why I keep saying that, it doesn't really matter. We're speaking with Anne Bremner and Doug Bremner. The book is Justice in the Age of Judgment. Hopefully we'll see it end of this year, beginning of next year. It'll be a really great read. Before we talk about the vaccines and some of the blogs that Doug has written regarding COVID vaccine, I just want to ask you, Anne, because there's some really fascinating parts of the book talking about your background and, you know, growing up with the Bremners, both you and Doug, you know, the intellectual curiosity comes through, the passion for doing the right thing and getting to the bottom of things. How did that evolve and develop in the Bremner household when you were young?
Well, I think there's that great Mark Twain quote that says, always do right. It'll gratify some and astonish the rest. I mean, I think we've always had that since we were kids. We write in the book, our mom died when we were little. I was 7, and I think Doug was 4. And I think that really was life-changing for us in terms of having purpose in our lives and maybe a sense of social justice and knowing that, you know, life is fleeting and life should have a purpose, you know, that you should be a part of something bigger than yourself. So I think that that developed pretty early with us. You know, our parents are wonderful. You know, they're both, our dad's a psychiatrist. And, you know, we were raised in a household with lots of books. Down in the basement, there was an old fruit cellar just with stacks of books that went back, you know, layers of books. And we all, you know, read quite a bit, and we were encouraged to use our brains. So our dad would always say when we leave for school, use your noodle. You know, if we'd say, well, so-and-so got a C, and it's like, well, that's not you. You know, you're going to get A's. And so we were encouraged academically, but also, I think, socially. And our parents are very, very philanthropic as well.
Doug?
A great recipe, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I'm sitting here out in the yard at Stanford. I'm here for my reunion. So,
oh, wow.
You are.
I'm at Stanford. Yeah, it's a beautiful night. They're having dinner on the quad, and it's just, you know, what a opportunity both Doug and I had in education, thanks to our folks.
Amazing. So you're talking to us instead of enjoying your reunion. We appreciate it, though. We appreciate it.
It was my pleasure.
One of the things about the book that we kind of tried to highlight is that, you know, I think there's a connection between what happened to us as children and then Anne becoming like an advocate for Amanda Knox and then also an advocate for Susan Cox Powell and for, you know, many of the other women who were victims of injustice. And like in some of my writing, when I, you know, like in You Can't Just Snap Out of It, which is a book I wrote for trauma victims. And, you know, the way I write for the regular people is different than the way I write research papers, right? You know, so I sort of try and make it so that's palatable. And when I wrote that book, I wrote about the effects of trauma on the brain, but then I also wrote about my own trauma in childhood, with our mother dying.
Sure.
And so I give it to all my patients and I say it's autobiographical. So if it makes you uncomfortable, just skip to the next chapter. And someone will come back and say, well, the pill didn't help me, doc, but the book did, you know? So when I write like that, I sort of try and show that, you know, I'm not like on some pillar and then I'm kind of looking down at these people that have had terrible things in their lives that I've had that too. And so it kind of makes you more human, you know, but some of the research we've done in PTSD shows that the people that do the best after a terrible life event are the ones who become advocates and who do altruistic things to sort of try and, you know, make things right, whatever it was that went wrong.
Wow. Yeah, that is interesting. To correct a wrong.
Yeah,
I think that you hit it on the head when you say that, you know, people who have suffered in different ways can find a passion. I think there's two ways you can go. And clearly, when you find the passion, it's almost like it's unstoppable. And, you know, you talk about in the book about getting to the bottom of things. And that's a great lesson for everything, not just for a lawyer or a psychiatrist or a writer, for anyone to be able to have that kind of interest. So I'm going to use that as a segue, because we're going to come back, Doug. We'll talk about Before You Take That Pill, the book, because I really think it's interesting and we need to have some conversation on that. But let's get to Lauren's question. You know, when we talk about getting to the bottom of things, you wrote years ago a blog saying flu shots are for idiots. And then you recently wrote in January of this year, COVID flu shots are not for idiots. So where do you see the difference? I mean, I think it's obvious, but go ahead. You wrote about it.
Well, yeah, so I wrote that last post because a lot of the people that had read my earlier post wanted to know my opinion, you know, and because obviously I'm not someone who's, you know, like I have a poster in my office that's from that Before You Take That Pill book, and it's a cartoon of a guy with all these pills flying out of the TV camera, and he's holding up the book to sort of try and protect himself from the from that. So, like, I'll just point to the poster and I'll say, you know, I'm not a drug pusher, but in your case, I think you need to take something for your depression or whatever. So I when I wrote that Before You Take That Pill, that originally came out of, I was an expert witness in some cases of acting medication called Accutane that was causing suicides and depression. And I became like the, you know, the world expert. And so I was involved in all this multi-district litigation and everything. And I had a lot of experience with that. And I thought, well, this pill, in my opinion, is really bad. And then there's a guy named David Graham of the FDA who came up with a list of 10 pills that he thought were very dangerous. And so then the Penguin said, well, why don't you just expand it and kind of go to all medications? And so I got into the topic of flu shots, and I came to the conclusion that there's not very good evidence that they're useful. And I wrote about that, and it even, you know, came to the point where my university was requiring people to get flu shots. And so they asked me to give a lecture, and it was called Why I'm Not Getting the Flu Shot. And so all the chief of staff of the hospital showed up and was standing in the back. Actually, the night before, they called me up and said, why are you giving this lecture? And I said, well, I'll give half of my time to someone else and we can have a debate, you know. But they weren't very happy about that. But so when I looked at, so comparing flu shots to, you know, with flu shots, there's no evidence that they really decrease mortality unless you're in a nursing home. And they don't, you know, their effects are kind of minimal and the flu keeps changing.
Right.
And I just don't think it's a good use of resources. But with COVID, my main thing with COVID is, you know, I'm part of the study now called RECOVER. It's researching the effects of COVID long-term. And we're seeing these long-term PTSD, depression, these psychiatric side effects, this brain fog, you know, the long hauler syndrome. And so I'm really worried about that, you know. So I think I don't think it's really comparable. So I got, you know, the flu shot and you know, but, you know, maybe this is.
Wait,
sort
you
of
got the flu shot?
No, I mean, the COVID.
I got the COVID. I also got a flu shot. That's just because they
made it. Had to.
Yeah. I used to say I wanted a religious exemption because I'm a Christian scientist because I was raised as a Christian and I'm also a scientist. then they made me give a letter from my pastor, so that's when I gave up on that. But anyway, it's I think it maybe it's an unfortunate effect of the fact that they kind of force flu shots on people that now people don't really trust it when they really should be with the COVID vaccine.
Doug,
you know, I have to ask Anne, because a couple of weeks ago we had Erwin Chemerinsky on, and, you know, you talk about being at Stanford. He's the dean of the, I would say, rival Cal and Berkeley. He talked about the constitutionality of mandates, and he was pretty clear that this shouldn't be an individual decision, notwithstanding individual rights are an important aspect of our existence in this country. But because of public health, You know, he gives a lot of examples of how rights are limited in certain ways. Where do you fall on this? Because I think it's a different perspective from Doug being, you being a lawyer, not the scientist, maybe the Christian, but not the scientist. Anne?
Right. I was going to say beat Cal, you know, Berkeley, and it's Stanford's big rival. But, you know, I've had a lot of police officers and firefighters reach out to me asking me to represent them in their quest to not have to meet the mandate. In Washington State, we have a mandate. And I have to tell you, I mean, as a lawyer, I believe in the mandate. I think it's a public health issue. You know, our dad was just in the hospital having surgery. He's 89, and he couldn't stay in the hospital. There were no beds because of COVID.
Yeah.
And when it hits home like that, you know, that it really, I mean, that really got to me. Like, you're kidding. I mean, you know, I just see it as, you know, a public health issue. I don't see a constitutional rights issue on individual rights. And the courts in our state and all over the country have basically sided on that side, which is a mandate's constitutional. You know, this is an epidemic that we've never seen in our lifetimes. And there's a way to combat it. And that's with a mandate and to have people vaccinated.
And I think that goes to Doug's point as well. When you differentiate something like the flu shot versus the COVID vaccine, and you look at the impact that the COVID vaccine has and the science behind it, there are reasons historically in the legal world and in civilization going back thousands of years as to why we have rules and what the basis is. And I think, Anne, you really summed it up by saying, you know, here's where you differentiate, and whatever you want to say about individual rights, this is something that is so important. And what's wrong with perhaps thinking of our fellow citizens and living in a world where maybe we can do something for someone else if the science... if the science promotes it, which it does. We have to take a break. We got one more segment with Anne Bremner and Doug Bremner. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. Yeah, we're back, and we're talking to Anne Bremner and Doug Bremner. The book is Justice in the Age of Judgment, and Simon & Schuster is publishing it. Hopefully, we will see the final copy end of the year, beginning of January, and maybe we'll have Anne and Doug back on once it gets out so we can talk specifically about the final product. You know, and sometimes when you write a book like this, there are some controversies in this divided world we live in. Doug, you've always had the guts to say almost anything in your book. Before you take that pill, you subtitled it, Why the Drug Industry May Be Bad for Your Health. When you talk about a drug industry being bad for your health, typically we think of the financial considerations and the money interests. But if that's the case, how do scientists like yourself or how do doctors allow for the drug industry to really be detrimental to someone's health?
Well, I think that's something that, you know, sort of emerged, you know, over the past few years since I wrote the book even, that it used to be that a lot of medical education was basically funded by the drug companies because, you know, the lecturers were paid by pharmaceutical companies, and then they would pay for the dinner for the doctors to go and listen to the lecture. They would pay for the meetings where doctors that were leaders in the field would get together and write these opinion articles where they would lay out what would be standard practice for a particular condition, which would usually, you know, be in favor of whatever the drug company was that had paid for that conference. And then if you didn't follow those guidelines, then it's like you're doing malpractice, you know. So and then they had something they called key opinion leaders, where they'd find two or three of the top people in the field, and they would court them. And then they knew that if they could sort of get them on their side by hiring them to be on the scientific advisory board or whatever, that they would influence other doctors, because it's really a kind of an apprentice system and not you kind of do what the doctor that trained you told you to do, and you're going to go to the meeting and you're going to see him present his research, and you know, so that's how some of these things get perpetuated. So when I wrote that book, I wanted to just go and read all the original papers myself and make my own decision about a particular drug. And just to give you one of many examples, there is one statin drug, which is to lower cholesterol, where they did a large study with, you know, 10,000 patients or something, and they found out that the drug wasn't better than, you know, than the another drug in terms of reducing heart attacks. So they hired a public relations person, and they said, well, how are we going to deal with this? And he said, just ignore it. Don't talk about the study, and no one will know that it ever happened. So, but, you know, that's not to say that there should be a complete separation, but, you know, it's just, I think that we have to be cognizant of how some of these things can have kind of subtle effects.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's opened my eyes just hearing you talk about how these studies get done that are paid by the companies who are like hawking their products. Basically, it doesn't sound like a good way to test products. But for a lay person, I mean, because you have obviously done the research and you know, you've been through the courthouse a million times talking about this stuff. But for the lay person, like, how do we figure out what drugs we actually need and have like a good purpose for us, and what is just being pushed on us by the pharmaceutical industry? Sometimes I see commercials for things that I didn't even know existed, or I've never heard of anyone suffering from, and I'm like, is that a real thing? We need drugs for that now?
Well, that was why I wrote that book. I was trying to write a guide that people could read that would be accessible and that the average person could kind of go through and get an unbiased, you know, view of what the research is for each particular drug, you know. So, you know, for an example, that for a long time people were pushing, you know, statins again for women who had not have a history of heart disease if their cholesterol was elevated. But, you know, we don't really have evidence that doing that will reduce your risk of getting a heart attack, which is all that, you know, it may bring your cholesterol level down, but that doesn't, what we really care about is that you prevent having a heart attack. So if you can't get that outcome, and then it's just going to make you, you know, have muscle pain or side effects, and, you know, that's not a very good deal.
Right.
The problem with that book is that, you know, people wait until something bad happens and then they go and read about it. You know, that, I mean, people are going to sit and read a whole book like that necessarily.
We also live in a time where there's pills for everything. And sometimes you're taking a medication, but you're taking another medication to combat the side effects of the first medication. And it's like a never ending.
Right. That's the problem. Yeah.
Sorry, Alan. Go ahead.
When I was going to say, when you said that, Doug, it made me think of, you know, what we're hearing just way too often now, that someone in the hospital with COVID, you know, taking one of the beds away from your father, for instance, says, you know, give me the vaccine. I didn't get the vaccine. And, you know, of course, the answer is from the doctor, it's too late. So when you talk about, you know, the situation where it only happens to you. I do workers' compensation law, and we deal with a lot of catastrophic injuries, and people don't understand. It's like the laws suck, and if it doesn't happen to you, you don't realize it. But then when it does, all of a sudden you're wondering, you know, why am I capped at this, and why can't I get this treatment, and why is there utilization review that denies everything that I need for treatment? So it's really kind of a sad situation, something that a lot of these causes that, Anne, I know you have championed for different needs and causes over the years. Before we let you go, tell us a little bit about what we can look forward to hearing about Anne Bremner coming up, other than, of course, the book, because we've talked about that. But what else is going on? I know I see you on all of this media all the time. You're commenting on just about everything that's going on. So I appreciate that. What else are you doing?
Well, I did want to just say that in the Susan Cox Powell case, where she's been missing, you know, for over 10 years, and then her children were with the father, the murderer, Josh Powell. This is in our book, but we tried this case to a jury that the state should never have left these kids with the murderer, and he killed the children. The jury awarded $115 million against the state for not protecting children, and I think that's a very important verdict that we have. It's on appeal right now, so that's what we're working on. It's being challenged by the state. But this jury, during a pandemic, listened to the trial. They were on hiatus for months, and they came back and unanimously found in favor of child welfare.
Well, wow. You know, that's you just want the right decisions to come down. And, you know, that case is a fascinating case. Yeah. I know you've talked about it on our show before. And, you know, hopefully it all turns out the way it should. Because it's just, there's so much injustice going on. We're going to have to close it out. I was saying, Anne, that, you know, what you're doing immediately, what you should be doing right now is enjoying your reunion.
That's
so
right.
Hopefully
it's
you
Stanford.
Have. Is it for the rest of the weekend you're going to be there?
Yeah, and it's such a pleasure being on with you. And I only brought up the Susan Cox Powell case because that jury wanted to be some bigger part of something bigger than themselves. And that's what we've been talking about here, I think, is, you know, trying to do those kinds of things. I know that's what you do, both of you do, and Doug does. And so I think that's an important message. But we're here for the weekend. It's been really fun. And it makes me feel really old, though. I'm like, it's been a lot of years since I went here. And it's good to be back. But it's a little perspective,
well,
that's for sure.
Both of you look very young, so don't worry about the aging. You know, yes, we know we're all getting on, but you're managing to keep yourselves, at least from your pictures, because I haven't seen you recently, but, you know, you're looking great. So have fun at the reunion and keep doing the right thing. Doug, it's been a pleasure having you on for the first time on Gervie's Law. I really appreciate your time.
Okay, thanks a lot, Alan.
Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you. You guys are wonderful.
All right. Have a great time there, Anne, and we'll speak to you soon. So that's going to do it. Lauren?
Alan? It's been a pleasure. Another one in the books.
Always. What do we have coming up next week?
Oh, I dare not say this early in the game. Things change.
They're going to cancel?
Rapidly. You saw how many emails go flying back and forth during the week? It's never a set show.
Yeah, Dick DeGaren canceled because he was afraid of the appeal of Robert Durst. So
Right. We'll
see what happens next week.
We will see.
All right, thanks for listening. See you next week.
This show was furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.